The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly, a podcast delayed by 24 hours so we could give you another chance to relive the best moments of England's performance in Denmark. On behalf of The Guardian and everyone associated with it, I would like to apologise for this error of judgment. As you know, millions flock to The Guardian for quality news every day. This is not one of those days. We will, however, endeavour to make the pod better than the game by asking questions like, how many holding midfielders is too many? Only connect. What comes next in the sequence? Gomez, Cody, Dyer, Cody. And would Gareth have learnt too much about Jack Grealish if he'd put him on for a tiny bit longer? And just think, if Foden and Greenwood had made it down for breakfast, we'd have watched a completely different squad managed by Sam Allardyce. Elsewhere, Scotland scraped past a team that was only picked a day ago. Northern Ireland are hammered and Ronaldo scores some more goals. There's great news if you want to watch every Premier League game on the TV. The EFL trophy begins, even though the last one didn't end. There's some transfer chat, plus upset PA announcers and Ricardo Quaresma on a horse. All that, plus your questions, and that's today's Guardian Football Weekly. On the panel today, Jonathan Wilson, hello.
Morning, how are you doing?
I'm tremendous, thank you very much. Ed Ahrens, nice to see you.
Good morning, how are you?
I'm all right. And Jordan Jarrett-Bryan, how are you?
Very well, sir, how are you?
I am delightfully well. Billy Payne writes, you delayed the pod record for this. Stuart says, is there any point having a pod after that match? Denmark holding England to one shot on target. Denmark faced three shots on target in their previous home match against Gibraltar. This, Jordan, was bad, wasn't it?
Oh, bad's being kind. It was shocking. I was defensive of Gareth Southgate after the Iceland game because I felt like first game back for England, players are a bit discombobulated. It's been a weird few weeks and few months. And Iceland did what Iceland essentially, as I understand it, do. They kind of block in and make it hard for you to break them down. This one, I'm going to struggle to defend them in this one because it was game two. I thought there were a couple of positives, but in the main, it wasn't very inspiring. I think when you have that generation of attacking talent, and granted a few of them aren't in the squad for various reasons, I think you've got to do a little bit better. I think my big concern is that it was 2 years on now from the World Cup where everybody was lauding Gareth Southgate. He was singing Atomic Kitten songs with his name in them. And football fans have very short memories. I think that credit in the bank that he built up in Russia, and I was there, that he did a great job, could be very quickly dissipating. And if he doesn't up the quality of performances very, very soon, I fear that a lot of the people I'm hearing from who want him out already, that could grow and grow and grow. He's done some good things, bringing the squad together, the unity he's brought, and we'll get to it later on. But I think that the discipline as well is something he needs to be careful that he doesn't become too friendly with them, and that bleeds into horrible performances.
There's something, Ed, sort of vaguely, I don't know, vaguely comforting about England being so stodgy, isn't it? It just reminds me of sort of most of my England supporting career.
Yeah, it was a sort of, well, not a throwback, just, you know, the kind of match that you're used to. I think the Nations League was supposed to get rid of games like this, wasn't it? Boring friendlies as such, you know, and have something to play for. But it just looked like both teams really weren't that bothered. I think the timing of the international break as well this time has been really, you know, it's not helped anyone, has it? Because, you know, the clubs are just about to start a new season, and it's been such a strange few months for everybody. But yeah, I think the really disappointing thing about England last night was, you know, just the lack of creativity that there was, and especially from, you know, from the wide areas, really. And I think, you know, the team set up to get the best out of Sterling and Sancho, and not necessarily their fault, but, you know, we really didn't see much from either of them last night, and it was very boring. And to be honest with you, I ended up, you know, having it on in the background, but just doing other things because it was, you know, just not very entertaining. So,
Wilson, I don't know if you're interested in formations and things like that, but England moved to a 3-4-3. Why?
I think Southgate quite rightly has been concerned how open they occasionally look in midfield. And I think, you know, the classic example of that is the Croatia game at the World Cup. When Jordan Henderson ended up sort of just doing sort of 50-yard shuttles back and forth across the pitch, getting nowhere near the ball. So that sort of trapezium shape of the three central defenders and the two holders sitting in front of that, that's a really easy way of generating solidity. And that's why I have to say I don't really care about the Nations League this time around. I think the Nations League is a very good idea, but these seem to be very much more in the mould of friendlies this time, just because of the nature of of where we are with pre-seasons and not pre-seasons, and it's all a bit basically don't get relegated. That's the only thing to worry about here. So working out a way of blocking up the midfield, I don't really have a problem with that. He did that. It's against Denmark. Now, has anybody ever since 1986, and I know they won the Euros in 1992, has anybody seen Denmark in a good game since 1986? It just doesn't happen. So the fact that it was a boring game away to Denmark, all games away to Denmark are boring. I watched an awful lot of Ireland playing Denmark, an awful lot. And trust me, compared to a lot of those games, last night was fantastic.
Thomas actually says, I don't have a question, just a sincere apology on behalf of all Danes for being one of the most boring teams in international football. But they made us look more boring than them. Is that a Danish skill?
Because, fundamentally, they had Christian Eriksen, who did a couple of nice things. And until Mason Mount came on, England didn't have a player creating in central areas. Now that was a decision Southgate had made to play with Sterling and Sancho, obviously play slightly wider. And there was a slight tactical issue there. And my one doubt with Southgate, I think all the PR stuff, all the stuff about getting the squad together, about eliminating club cliques, all of that I think he's done really, really well. Even with the Foden and Greenwood stuff, I don't have a problem with how he's handled that. I think he's, in terms of saying the right thing and doing the right thing politically, diplomatically, all that's been great. I have had tactical questions about him. So the Colombia game at the World Cup, for instance, I thought England invited pressure needlessly in the last 10, 15 minutes. The Croatia game obviously went badly wrong and he didn't react in the second half. I think there is a question there when you have such attacking, certainly on the right, such attacking wing-backs, why would you then play with wide forwards? You need them tucked in. And when Mount came on, who is a more naturally central player, it looked more cohesive. But, given it's the first time they've played that system, and given that a lot of the players, well, all the players clearly aren't anywhere near proper match fitness, I don't really think you can judge anything other than a vague intent of how do we block up this midfield?
Sure.
And how will that serve us going forward?
But
the problem is you can't only do that against really good teams. You need to work out the shape against the slightly below the top level teams. And if that, the result of that will be some games are really, really boring and don't quite work. And last night was one of them. And if he's written off his Nations League campaign, I think written off may be too strong, but if he's seen it more as an opportunity to experiment and to get things right for the Euros rather than focusing on it in and of itself, I think that's, in the circumstances, a totally reasonable thing to do.
I agree. All the reasons that Wilson has laid out as to why he likes Southgate, I'm the same. But I think tactically there are some questions that he has to answer and answer quickly. I don't mind so much the stodgy, boring games as long as there's a wider plan that we can see come tournament time. Because that those times to be stodgy and hard to break down and hard to beat, I think we'll need that. But I think it's a bit ironic that we've got all the attacking talent we've got. It's a bit like we should be like Arsenal 10 years ago, where we're never going to win any trophies, but we're great to watch going forward. We always score lots of goals, great attacking talent. But defensively, you think they're going to concede goals, because I don't think we've got great defenders per se. But if you look at the top half, we've got great attackers. But it's the other way around. We seem to be defensively, non-threatened and solid, but attacking wise, we seem to be very, very stodgy. And I think he's got to find a way to really get in the central of the park, players on the ball who can make things happen. And hopefully that will be Foden and Mason Mount going forward. But we haven't really seen that yet.
But I mean, to be fair to Southgate, last year England scored more goals than any other calendar year in history. So last year the attack was fine. If he sort of thought, yeah, okay, we've pretty much ticked that box, it's the other end we need to get right. And then as we get nearer the Euros, we try and sort of merge them together. I think that's a totally reasonable thing to do. Also, they haven't played a game did they play in March?
You say that, but France scored loads of goals. Belgium the other day, all these teams haven't, and all these other big sides seem to not be that bothered that they haven't all.
Well, Belgium
together.
Scored loads of goals because England's brave Lions, it had wearied the poor Icelandic.
Ed, you're trying to get in.
Yeah, I just think the biggest, Jordan mentioned it as well at the back, but also I think a big concern for Southgate is going to be central midfield. And, I was pleased to see Calvin Phillips given a chance yesterday, and I'm sure he'll get another go. And Declan Rice, again, was okay, but I think that's the biggest area where England are short, actually. If you look going, especially in the sort of a holding midfielder and box-to-box player, and obviously Foden, where does Foden play?
Is it that we don't have a player that can both hold, but actually also pick the ball up on the half turn and play a forward pass that looks, you know, that, that can get through the defence?
Yeah, I think, well, there's a lack of players like that, but there's also a lack of... I think the midfield is the, probably the weakest part of the team in overall, the squad anyway, overall. And, you know, we really need someone to step up. And obviously Jordan Henderson wasn't there, and he would be in the team if he was around. But somebody to play alongside him in a two in that system, I'm not sure who it would be, but it's, you need to be pretty dynamic to play in that 3-4-3. In the centre and you know, really get about the pitch quite a lot. So I think that is a big area of concern for him, and that's why he, you know, brought in Phillips to give him a go and see what he was like in that position.
I actually said I'm not a big Declan Rice fan, but I thought actually he played quite well. I thought he did a decent to very good job personally, and I also think that how Southgate deals with this Phil Foden situation going forward will be interesting, because he's the guy that we've all been kind of saying is that guy on the half turn that can get the ball, look up and spot a pass. But does he discipline him by omitting him from the next squad to make a point or what? I don't know, but it feels like the Foden dynamic is could answer that question of that midfield central kind of creativity.
Do you prefer, Jonathan, a long diagonal pass that doesn't have enough on it and the opposing fullback just heads it clear, or a long diagonal pass that sails out of play but the intended recipient puts his thumb up in acknowledgement to say that was exactly the right thing to do?
Clearly the former, because you can pick up the second ball. Unless you really want, you're playing like rugby and you really want to pin him in on the line out.
Zander says, I haven't seen Eric Dier do anything remotely useful for at least two seasons. Why did Mourinho Southgate keep insisting on picking him? What am I missing here? I think this is interesting because I really like him as a bloke and I want him to be brilliant, and I can't work out, I don't think he's brilliant, but I just don't know how I feel about him anymore, Ed.
Yeah, he's all right. I mean, I think, look, that is... The question for him, and it's a bit like Rice actually, what is his best position? And, you know, he spent a lot of time playing in midfield. Now he's playing in defence, and Rice is the other way. But supposedly Chelsea see him as a defender and are looking to buy him and play him in the back three. So it's a matter of, I think those players, you can suffer from that. It's good to be versatile at times, but it's also, you know, you need to be a specialist in your position to play at the very highest level. And I think maybe Dier, I'm not sure if he's, you know, he's a decent squad player and that versatility helps him in that respect. But I think, you know, if England are looking to challenge at a tournament, I'm not sure he should be in the team.
And just to your dire question there, Max, I had a thought last night about Pochettino, and I wonder if he's going to wait until next summer's Euros to see how well England do. And if between now and the Euros, the form going into it is poor and England don't get to at least the semi-finals, which effectively will be a home tournament for us next summer, I wonder if the talk of Pochettino taking over from Southgate may kind of grow legs. I know he's got quite a long-term contract. I'm trying to sack him already. But I wonder if Pochettino would like that England job. And then people like Dier, Kane, Ali, who he's worked with at Spurs, there's a dynamic there of maybe he can get the best out of those kind of handful of players. But it's a long shot. But I'm just wondering if in the back of his mind he's thinking, wait 12 months and let's see if that England job comes up.
Wilson, you're looking dismissive.
I think Pochettino would be a tremendous disappointment for England. I can't conceive for the life of me why a man in his prime would willingly seize the chalice, fill it to the brim with hemlock, and then down it in one.
He's just missed having Harry Kane's team talks. That's what it is.
He will at some point in the next season get offered a really big club job, and he should take it.
Ed, you mentioned Harry Kane's team talks. As a digression to All or Nothing for a second, I don't know what I was expecting, but they're so bad, aren't they? I mean, like, they're worse than I do on a Saturday afternoon. That it's a, like, obviously, you know, what else are you going to say about from, come on, lads, let's effing do this?
I was wondering what his one last night was like, because it was a game where, you know, clearly neither team was that up for it. And I just wonder if he was sort of, you know, come then.
Lloris does it with more heart, doesn't he? I think.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's Kane that sort of feels the pressure of, you know, that situation or not, because I don't think he does. You know, he's clearly used to being the centre of attention and stuff. And when whenever I've spoken to him in the media, he's very confident and stuff like that. But he's just, maybe he's, I don't know, he's not really one of those, you know, sergeant major types who can, you know, is going to inspire you. He inspires you rather by his actions, isn't he? But I have to, you know, it's just really, that's the thing that I've taken from All or Nothing. It's just how like uninspiring they are, really. And, but, you know, he's trying his best.
Can we talk about Jack Grealish for a second? Thrown off the last 15 minutes, he created more chances on the pitch than Sancho, Calvin Phillips, Declan Rice, Harry Kane combined. He was born on the right side of midfield in a position that he hasn't really played before. What's the point? I mean, it was screaming out for him or someone like him.
Yeah, I mean, I've not been of the majority of people that have said, oh, why is he not in the squad? He should be in the squad. It's a disgrace. It's quite clear that his best position, as far as I see it, is a number 10. And England don't play a number 10 traditionally. So his omission isn't based off of he's not good. It's just that he doesn't work in the system. So I've understood why he's not being picked completely. And I know he can play wide, but wide, there are better players than him. He did play well when he came on, and I think the pressure now is on Southgate to look at him strongly and maybe find a role for him to be in that squad. But he did look quite effective and impressive when he did come on. But up until now, I've understood why he's not been part of that squad.
Robert says, after the last couple of mediocre England performances, should Danny Rose demand an explanation from Gareth Southgate for his continued omission and demand a move to a nation who will appreciate appreciate him more? I mean, it's a problem that there were no left-footed players, you know, anywhere. Oh, Tyrone Mings is left-footed, isn't he? Could have played on the left of the three.
I wondered why they didn't bring Maitland-Niles or start Maitland-Niles on the left, because he was man of the match in the Community Shield last week, and they brought him on the right. And you know, and then in the first match as well, he seems to really like Trippier.
It was Trippier's cleverly disguised through ball, which set up the Harry Kane chance, wasn't it?
Now, let's talk about what happened after we finished recording, but had happened before we started recording. Phil Foden and Mason Greenwood sent home in disgrace on Monday night after inviting women to the England team hotel in Iceland. If I've understood it correctly, they booked separate rooms. So they were sort of either just trying to get away with it or sort of thinking about the COVID bubble in a weird kind of way. Totally ridiculous. Mason Greenwood and Phil Foden, as producer Jack says, a couple of, I quite like this phrase, boilerplate shamed football apologies on Monday. Having now had the chance to reflect on what happened, said Mason Greenwood, I can only apologise to everyone for the embarrassment I've caused. In particular, I want to apologise to Gareth Southgate for letting him down when he had shown great trust in me. Phil Foden, I will learn a valuable lesson from this error in judgment, and I wish Gareth and the team good luck this week. It's a sort of I'm sorry I got caught type thing. Southgate last night was angrier than when his first press conference, when he sort of said, I was still trying to find out the details. I don't really understand how players could have found that acceptable, whether there had been a COVID breach or not. The players would have been sent home. Your thoughts, please. Jonathan Wilson.
Well, it's one of those things, simultaneously nothing at all, but also quite serious. I think, let's leave aside bubbles and COVID and like to start with that when you're away with your club or your country, that is showing significant disrespect to your manager and the other teammates. You know, there's a level of professionalism that is expected, and that is not that. And there's a code of behaviour to which you subscribe, whether tacitly or actually, and that's in breach of that. So for that alone, I think it was right to send them home. Then the COVID situation, you've got to be so much more careful now. So you look at Jofra Archer, who between the first and second tests of the summer, you popped into his house on the way between Southampton and Manchester, and he was rightly dropped for the next game because this presumably has been hammered into the players. These are the rules. We have to conform to this, these bubble restrictions, or this sport cannot carry on. And no matter how sort of innocent it was in Jofra Archer's case, or slightly more mischievous / sordid in the case of Greenwood and Foden, you just can't do it. So I would leave him out for the next squad as well. And I think a wider point has to be made. And I take the point absolutely that England need Foden, and in the future they will need Greenwood. But I think there's the bigger thing here is squad discipline. And in the same way Raheem Sterling was dropped after the Joe Gomez incident, they have to be dropped for the next two games. And then it's over and you move on, and hopefully everybody's learned their lesson and it's forgotten about.
Anybody think it should be more draconian or less draconian than that? As Harry Kane said, they know they've made a mistake. They're young boys coming into a big world. It won't happen again.
Well, I think it's going to be particularly disappointing for Southgate, given that they were the two that had just been, you know, made their debuts. And who they are in particular, just to sow, you know, so much excitement. We talked about Foden already, and Greenwood, you know, just being the outstanding, you know, breakthrough star of youngster of the Premier League season. And yeah, I think there's there's going to be a big disappointment. And also at United, where I don't know if anybody remembers, but back in when Greenwood had just scored a couple of goals after a live game, I can't remember which game it was, but Solskjaer just sort of hinted that Greenwood, you know, he was a bit worried about Greenwood. He said he needs to live his life properly off the pitch as well. And no one kind of really, you know, realised what he might have been referring to at the time. But I think, you know, perhaps it was this kind of thing that he's just got to keep his mind on the game and try and, you know, not be distracted, because, you know, these kind of things are going to come up a lot now. He's you know, found fame and fortune and doing so well for United. So, yeah, in particular, I think that, though, you know, for those two to have fallen foul of the rule so badly was a real blow for England.
Yeah, anyone that knows me always describes me as someone that's a bit dramatic and OTT, but I think this is really, really bad. And I don't subscribe to this, they're young, they make mistakes stuff. Yes, they are young. Young people make mistakes. But there's two things to this. The first thing is, as young red-blooded men, you know, obviously women crazy, I get it, at that age, you get fame and money and all this sort of thing. I don't understand why in the time when you get your first call-up in your first game, women is on your mind anyway. I thought to myself, if that was me, how would I react? I've been called up, I'm about to play a game, I've just played a game. Why are women on your mind anyway? Just wait till you get back and then you can do whatever you want to do. I don't understand why that was something they got caught up in. And I think the second thing, which is a wider problem, is Southgate reclaiming control and discipline of the squad. Because it's not been a good week for England when you factor in the whole Maguire situation as well. And I think that, going back to my first point earlier on, in that if Southgate doesn't start to make that definition or kind of that line between, I'm your friend, we're together, we're all youngish, I know you guys from under 21, that's great. But also, I'm also your boss and you're here to do a job and uphold certain standards, I think this could spiral out of control very, very quickly. And I hope those young players don't think that they can take liberties with Southgate because he comes across as he's that parent that, oh yeah, I want to be their friends. And in my culture, where I'm from, parents and kids, they're not your friends. There's a line, and he needs to draw that line between, this is England, I'm your boss, this is not acceptable. Otherwise, this could very quickly, I think, spiral out of control.
I thought Snapchat, you only had like 7 seconds to talk to somebody. I mean, I was never very good at flirting, but I just don't think I'd have got to that stage within that short. I'd have still been like trying to, you know, have you got any brothers and sisters? Do you know, what's your favourite movie? Maybe it just...
Wait, hang on, sorry, what's your favourite car? Your first line when you talk to somebody was, have you got any brothers or sisters?
He did say he's not very good at flirting, to be fair. He did say that.
The idea, you took kind of a German GCSE oral and thought that was a blueprint.
Do you remember the early stages of dating when you were just like, you run out of things to say after about 5 minutes and you were like, oh God, I wish I'd had some bullet points written down for this terrible phone call.
Fräulein, hast du Geschwister?
Exactly. Hast du Haustiere? Anyway, that'll do for part one. Part two, we'll round up the rest of the Nations League to a bit of transfer chat as well. Welcome to part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Now, look out on Saturday's Guardian for a 40-page guide to the Premier League season. Barry has written something. Barney, Johnny Lou, Troy Townsend, Marina Hyde, Kelly Cates. Anything from you, Wilson? Nothing in there?
No, neither was I.
But still, I mean, neither were you, Ed. Jordan, anything from you?
No.
So only the good writers are in this one. It has a very smart team-by-team guide as well, free with Saturday's Guardian. So go and buy it, please. Scotland beat the entirely new Czech Republic team 2-1, having been behind, and they rode their luck a bit. Melvin says, who is doing more to damage the cause of Scottish independence, Boris Johnson or Steve Clark? Who is the best centre-half, Scott McTominay or a 68-year-old Gordon McQueen? you would think, I mean, I suspect, Wilson, that, you know, when a squad is just brought together like that, there's a real kind of, you know, spirit about them. But you'd hope that you would win that more convincingly, would you? Or should we, you know, a win's a win?
Well, look, a win's a win. It's the first time Scotland have beaten Czech Republic twice in a row for 80-something years. I mean, I don't know how often they played in that time, but it was the famous game when they got to the, I'm going to say, the 74 World Cup, when Joe Jordan scored against Czechoslovakia. So they have definitely played the Czechs, or the Slovaks. It would have been more Slovaks in that 73. So, sorry, I'm digressing.
No, you're just having a conversation with yourself that we are all party to.
I don't think Scotland at the moment are in a position to sort of belittle any win. It's a win away to the Czechs. It's coming slightly fortuitous circumstances, but great, you know, take it.
Northern Ireland lost, hammered by Norway 5-1. Erling Braut Haaland was brilliant, wasn't he? His first goal was just an absolutely glorious sort of volleyed side foot pass with real power into the top corner. Stephen Davis broke Pat Jennings' Northern Ireland appearance record, so well done to him. And Craig Cathcart was a sort of half the speed of Erling Braut Haaland for the one where the ball went over the top and then Haaland squared it to Sirloth. Victor says Haaland and Sirloth's combined height is 12'8". They scored 4 goals in their first game starting together. Proper football men know you should pair a tall fella with a shorter one. What are some great historical pairings of two big number nines playing up front together? We've spent some time thinking about this because I kind of think even with like a Shearer Sheringham, in that situation, Sheringham is the big man and Shearer is the little man. And actually in Beardsley Lineker, even though Beardsley is shorter than Lineker, Beardsley's the big man because I think big is the creative one and the little one is the one on the sort of just on the line, you know, who's going to get in behind.
Well, there's two classic kinds of strike pairings, aren't there? There's big man, little man. Your Quinn Phillips, if you will. And then I'm going to put this purely in terms of Sunderland strike pairing so that everybody can understand. And then you also have the one where somebody drops off. So the Eric Gates, Marco Gabbiadini pairing. So I think Beardsley Lineker is more that latter type where Beardsley dropped off and would feed it to Eve Lineker. Or Dalglish Rush would have been like that. Whereas Toshak Keegan was big man, little man. So the double big man that occurred to me, and it was, I think, pretty much a one off. Was the last half hour of Ireland against the Netherlands in the 1990 World Cup when they went full Quinn and Cascarino, who I think were both 6'4", so it's the same 12'8" between them, and of course eventually this bombardment. Was it a terrible mistake by, was it Van Breukelen in goal for the Dutch?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah,
just spilled a ball that was under no pressure, and now Quinn poked it in. Classic Charlton.
Any better big man partnerships, Jordan?
I think the best I came up with was Crouch and Walters from Stoke. I don't think I kind of topped that one. Ferguson and Shearer at Newcastle. Shearer wasn't huge, but he was an aerial presence, so that gives him an extra two inches for me.
I think Crouch sort of he would push the scales too far, I think, you know? So I don't think he should be, I don't think he's sort of an outlier.
Is he cheating? Is that cheating?
Yeah, it's cheating to have Crouch in your one. Eds was the best, definitely.
Well, I'm not sure they ever actually played together, but it would be good if they did, because Adi Akinbaye and Neil Shipperley was certainly the heaviest, would have been the heaviest big man partnership. And I just wanted to mention the little man partnership as well. And there's not been many.
Yes.
John Spencer and Mark Steen was not the original one, but I'd always remember that one for Chelsea, just before Chelsea got all the money.
You could just see Jose knocking it long to Steen and Spencer, couldn't you? Just getting the knockdowns from them.
I think I'm right in saying Preston's front five from the 1938 Cup final. Not a single one of them was over 5'7". I think that's right.
Is that front five shorter than Alexander Sørloth and Erling Braut Haaland, Wilson?
Well, no.
Well, they could have been
five times.
Yeah, but they could have been 4 foot or 3 foot. You know, I'm not to know. Football started in 1993 for me. Remember,
let's say a 5.5 foot average.
Okay,
so that makes 27.5 feet, okay, as opposed to 12 foot. So it's roughly double.
Okay,
they've gained a man.
Now, Cristiano Ronaldo went past 100 goals for Portugal with a brace against Sweden. Two great goals. He's on 101. The world record is Ali Daei of Iran with 109. Lionel Messi is on 70 if you want to make any comparisons with this. Do you think Ronaldo will make it, Jordan? Do you think he'll just keep going until he gets there?
No, I don't know. I think he will try to, but I think he'll come up short.
He's definitely trying to. It's a big goal for him.
Oh, yeah.
I read a good article about this like recently, but he's really, that's one of his main drivers to keep going to break that record. And
no, so, I'm sure he'll get there. Even suddenly end up playing five friendlies in a row against San Marino next summer, he will get there.
I'd love it if they organise that. That would be absolutely great, wouldn't they? Just try and get Portugal relegated to Group D of the Nations League, just to see him in with Malta and the Faroes. That would be great. France 4, Croatia 2. Dejan Lovren scored a brilliant goal. But Martial and Griezmann got to work and France made easy meat of Croatia in the end. Belgium went behind to Iceland, but won 5-1. Lovely back heel from Michy Batshuayi. And a first for 18-year-old Jeremy Doku. Look out for him, I've written. I mean, he might already play for Barcelona. I don't know, but it was a lovely goal. Italy beat the Netherlands in Amsterdam. Terrible luck for Roma midfielder Nicola Zaniolo, tore his ACL in his left knee, having missed the first 6 months of 2020 with the same injury in the right knee. Transfer watch, everybody. So Doucouré and James Rodriguez confirmed to Everton. Wilson, you wrote a piece about Rodriguez, didn't you?
Yeah, I mean, he's just one of these players who you sort of, in your mind, you sort of think, oh, yeah, he's this great young talent. And then suddenly he's 29 and you sort of think, well, where did that time go? And Everton have a habit of signing players. I mean, Theo Walcott, I guess, is another example of that. But Everton's huge problem at the minute is they keep signing players from bigger teams. So you look at, Walcott, Iwobi, Moise Kean. So, okay, Iwobi and Kean are still young. James, Yerry Mina, Lucas Dean. And Lucas Dean was brilliant last season, but they still signed from Barcelona. There's a couple of others. And the result is they pay massive wages. And so they're the 19th richest club in the world by revenue. But if you look at the top 20, nobody else has a wages to turnover ratio anywhere near as high as their 85%. And that's going to bite at some point, because that's before James and Allen, who are both 29, and Doucouré, who I imagine is on reasonably high wages, are taken into account. So they will have to trim that budget at some point soonish.
Yeah, and they're building a new stadium, of course.
Yeah. But, I mean, leaving the boring financial stuff aside, if I was an Everton fan, I'd be incredibly excited to have Hammers, because 6 years ago, he looked like the best player of his generation.
I'm quite excited by Everton, which is, I've never said that before in my entire life, but they've got a champion manager there, top manager, who's making some good signings. And, they're my outside shout to finish sixth, because Ancelotti's not gone there and made these signings to just finish top half of the table. He'll be thinking, I want to finish sixth minimum. And that might sound ridiculous, but I don't think he'll be thinking that. You've got a manager there that has won Champions League titles. He'll be thinking, we should be looking to put pressure on that top four. Whether they do it or not, we'll see. But I think the ambition from him, and thus from the club, is extremely high this season. So I want to see how they get on.
Newcastle's bizarrely sensible window continues. They've confirmed Jamal Lewis from Norwich. Ed, Crystal Palace have got Batshuayi on loan for the season. How you feel? Is Soloth still with you? You could go big man, big man.
Well, yeah, and Benteke as well. We could have triple big man.
Big man.
Batshuayi is not that big, though. I think there's a misconception. He's not as tall as everyone thinks. No, that's really good for Palace. I mean, he's was obviously there before, and he was quite keen to come back, I'm told. And, he's a goal getter. Doesn't contribute much else around the pitch, but Palace, they've signed Eze from QPR, and as things stand, Zahar's going to be there for the first game at least. And, obviously Jordan Ayew's very creative as well, good player. So hopefully create the chances for Batshuayi should be a good signing. But yeah, as Newcastle, some really impressive signings. I think it's good to see Wilson and Fraser staying together and, reviving the old band.
Sorry, just on the big man. Yeah. Wimbledon's front three, when they lost 3-2 to Everton in 1994, was Holdsworth, Clark and Gale.
Okay,
which is proper good, big man.
Batshuayi's 6'1". Where's the line? I'd say that is big man.
It's reasonably big, but it's not. I think a proper big man has to be 6'2 plus.
Just on the Wilson thing very quickly, this Callum Wilson signing by Newcastle. Everyone said it's a really good signing, and I understand why, but his injury record is not particularly great. And I think 20 million these days feels like not a lot of money. But I wonder if you want to make your marquee signing a guy that doesn't have a great track record of staying fit. That could work out quite well, but I'm on the fence on that one. I like Callum Wilson, but they need a guy that they can guarantee will score 15 goals, and he can, but I'm not sure if you want to bank on your marquee striker signing being him personally.
More importantly, the brilliant Hawksby and Jacobs were saying, look, Wilson and Fraser is the start of Steve Bruce buying an entire Dad's Army team, trying to get Ben Godfrey in. They really struggled with Captain Mannering. It's very hard to know. Is there a Mannering in professional football? And Sonny Pike's professional football career, didn't quite work out, did it? That would have been a decent signing. Chelsea in for Edouard Mendy from Rennes, on the recommendation of Petr Cech. I like the idea of a goalkeeper looking at another goalkeeper going, he's a good goalkeeper. Interesting story of Mendy. 5 years ago, 23, was unemployed, queuing at a local job centre, ready to quit football. What do you know, Ed? You do transfer digging, don't you?
Yeah, I was looking into this yesterday, actually, because he's a Senegal international as well, but he was born in France. And he started off his career, I can't remember which club it was, but his local club. And then I think there was an unscrupulous agent involved in his story, which ended up with him being, ditched and left without a club, basically left unemployed for a year. And then he has come back from that to, become Rennes' number one and help them get into Champions League last season, and is likely to be coming to put pressure on Kepa, who's obviously still the world record for a goalkeeper transfer. That was from Chelsea. It's going to be an interesting dynamic there to see if he can force his way in.
Villa close to a 28 million club record signing for Ollie Watkins from Brentford. Alexander Kolarov's gone from Roma to Inter. I mean, he must be a million years old now, Kolarov, but still doing it. The Women's Super League deadline's on Thursday night. Lucy Bronze has gone back to Man City from Lyon. 3 seasons, 3 French League titles, 3 Champions Leagues. Manchester United women set to sign World Cup winning United States forwards Tobin Heath and Christian Press as well. Producer Jack says, read Dad's Army. Steve Bruce could get Matty Mannering out of retirement. He played for Stalybridge, Celtic, Chester and Macclesfield. He's still only 30, so every chance there. He's an Ireland under 19 international as well. That'll do for part two. Part three, we'll begin with every Premier League game on the TV for the rest of time. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. So the Premier League announced that all 28 games played in September will be broadcast live in the UK under pressure from the Football Supporters Association, who are good people doing good things. They'll be broadcast via Sky, BT, Amazon Prime Video, BBC. Sky and BT got the first pick, have already selected 17 games for the first 3 rounds of the new campaign. This is a good idea. I mean, it's bad for people like us who have to watch all the games because we have to watch all of them, but it is good for fans who would go to the matches who I guess are potentially more important than us, Wilson.
Yeah, I suppose so. I mean, I'm not going to be watching all the games, just to be absolutely clear. If anybody thinks I'm going to do that, then I will be much more picky than I was towards the end of last season. There's no real... Given people can't go to games, there's no reason not to put them on telly.
Yeah. I mean, the issue is for us is, if Burnley, Crystal Palace, my apologies, Ed, was on Match of the Day... We'd only have to watch the 7 minutes that Match of the Day did to know as much as anyone else, really. But now the whole game is on. We have to watch it all to know what's happened when we talk about it, which is that makes it tricky for people aren't thinking about
seriously
podcasters.
The number of people who will actually watch Burnley Crystal Palace is not huge. I think we can get away with it. Or just make Barry watch it. Just tell Barry we're all watching it, and then just ask him a question.
It's a very good idea. But sometimes he just does that look where he goes, and these never make the edit. He just goes, Can you ask somebody else? we've all heard that sentence. None of you had. But it's an interesting point is, you know, possibly, Jordan, that every Premier League game from now on for the rest of the time could be on TV. I mean, they may not go back on this. I don't know if that is a good or a bad thing. I don't know.
Well, I want to be quite miserable and contrary and say that, you know, it's never good to have too much of anything, and it's going to be an overload and a vomit load of football for the next few months. That's not a good thing. But you know what? Bring it on, sod it. Let's just watch all the games and let's get on with it. And as Jonathan says, you just pick and choose the ones that you want to watch, because I won't be watching all the games either, but I'll just be very selective with the games that I do watch. So, as you mentioned, this could be the situation for the next 3, 4, 5 months. So let's just get on with it, really.
Kevin De Bruyne's won the PFA Player of the Year award. Is that the right choice, Ed?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting choice. And I think I would, if I was a player, well, I obviously didn't play against him in a match, but I would imagine that's what that award is based on, isn't it? The PFA award, that, you know, you're voting for your peers. And you know, most of them have come up against De Bruyne and everybody else in the last season, and that's not surprising that he's the one that most people have said was the outstanding player, because you can imagine being on the same pitch as him would probably take your breath away a little bit. You can, you know, just some of the things that he does, you know, it's kind of like no one else in the league does that. So I wasn't surprised, and I think he did deserve it, actually. Yeah. So
I have spoken to some ex-pros about the voting, and you know, it is sometimes they're just sitting there in the dressing room and just copying the person next to them because they can't remember any centre-backs, for example. But yeah, he's a good footballer, isn't he? Do you want the team of the year? Nick Pope, Trent Alexander-Arnold, Virgil van Dijk, Kaglar Soyuncu, Andrew Robertson, David Silva, Jordan Henderson, Kevin De Bruyne, Jamie Vardy, Aubameyang and Sadio Mane. I mean, it is. They always vote for it too early, don't they? I mean, I don't know if they still voted for this in March, but you sort of think the way Leicester tailed off, if Soyuncu would have got in there, if they'd waited till the end of the season. I don't know why they can't wait till the end of the season, but anyway, it's only I don't think it really matters particularly. Beth England won the Women's Awards, having helped Chelsea to the Women's Super League and League Cup double. A question for you, Jonathan, from Nifty Palms, who says, after what point of Sunderland's 8-1 win over Aston Villa under-21s in the EFL Trophy, did Jonathan Wilson feel his joy turn to disgust due to the win being too easy?
No, I mean, look, as people will know, Aston Villa beat Sunderland very controversially in the 1913 FA Cup final. And frankly, they've had it coming. And 107 years later, we got our revenge. Have some of that.
Cambridge 2, Fulham under-21s 0. So Cambridge are going to win every game and get a clean sheet in every game this season. It's wonderful. Despite Ben Fisher writing in The Guardian today that they were one of the relegation candidates. So this was the first competitive game in England with fans. I don't know what the new rules... Obviously, I don't know what the new rules mean. I'm trying to work out if they mean I can play on Saturday for my amateur team.
I think you can.
You can, yeah. Organised sports.
No, you haven't seen us play. We're not that organised. I'll be brutally honest.
But you're right. Presumably, the new rules mean you can't have fans in games.
I don't know. I mean, Cambridge are due to have fans at their League Two game on Saturday.
You can have up to six fans.
No, it's not fans of up to six households.
God knows.
I mean, this is the. I mean, I'm not ashamed of us not knowing.
No, no one knows.
Put it that way. Nick says Portsmouth played in the first round of the EFL Trophy this evening, yesterday, while still waiting for last season's final. Any idea whether this has ever happened before? Dave's saying the EFL Trophy kicked off tonight before the final of last season's been played. How will this be settled? As a good proportion of the players of both finalist clubs have moved on, there's 42,000 plus Pompey fans with tickets, including me, are waiting to find out what's happening, as well as the Salford fans too. I did some cursory Googling. I went onto the official website and couldn't find out much about when the final's due to be played. So I don't know if it is due to be played or not, or maybe they just wait until the end of this one and then have like a double final. Who knows?
So there is a sort of precedent for this. So as I'm sure you're aware, the first year of professionalism in Uruguay was 1933.
Yes.
And Nacional and Peñarol finished level on 46 points at the top of the table. Mm-hmm. So they didn't manage to get a playoff arranged, because obviously they hadn't invented goal difference by then. But they managed to get a playoff arranged for May the 27th, the following year. In that game, a shot by a Peñarol player hit the medicine box of a Nacional physio, bounced back into play, and was then put in. A huge fracas breaks out. Three players are sent off. It appears that Nacional have won the game, but this goal is then subsequently ruled out. So they have to arrange a second playoff. They don't get that on until September the 2nd, 1934. So the 1934 championship is ongoing at this point. They play for 90 minutes, 0-0. They played an hour's extra time, and it's still 0-0. So they have to arrange a third playoff, which they don't get on until November the 18th. So this is more than a year after the previous season's finished. They play the playoff. They go 1-0 up, an equaliser. They go 2-1 up, and then Hector Castro equalised on 61 with his second goal, complete his hat-trick on 77. And so Nacional win the league, and they win the 1934 title 3 days later. So they won the league twice in the space of 3 days. Hector Castro scored that hat-trick. What do we know about Hector Castro?
Well, obviously, we know, but could you let the listeners know?
He only had one arm, having cut off his left arm in a buzzsaw accident when he was 12 years old.
There's a round of applause there. Thanks for existing, Wilson. You know, it's important that you're here. An EFL spokesman has said regarding Portsmouth v Salford, discussions remain ongoing with both clubs in respect to the final. Despite the various logistical and operational challenges, it remains the objective of the league to find a suitable solution that will allow us to stage the final with as many supporters in attendance as possible, as long as it is safe to do so. Until we receive further clarity on how we can achieve this alongside the view of both clubs, the game remains postponed and we will advise of any further developments as soon as they are available. Another question for you, Jonathan. Alan asked me this on Monday, but you weren't here. On Wednesday, as requested, says Alan, will there be a Bielsa special with Wilson this week? Put it out as a one-off bonus pod if necessary. I'd like an hour of Wilson explaining just why we should be excited beyond the Leeds back in the Premier League narrative. I don't want an hour, Wilson, but I'll give you like a minute or two. And, you know, over the course of the season, we will no doubt talk about Marcelo Bielsa.
Well, I think it's two things. One is tactically, he's fascinating. You know, he even though the rest of the world is sort of been inspired by him to sort of take pressing to new levels, he is still at a you know, incredibly intense level of pressing. And I think that's why it's really interesting to play Liverpool first, is you have two slightly different models of pressing. So he was a real pioneer of that. He was a pioneer of video analysis. So a lot of the things he did in the 90s, which are radical, have now become sort of normalised. But it's also the fact he is utterly uncompromising. You know, he won't look at Liverpool and think we should rein it in a bit because it's Liverpool. He'll think, well, Liverpool's weaknesses, right, we'll hit them there. And he will attack them. So I think that game on Saturday should be that's a 5:30 game on Saturday, I think. It should be fascinating. But it's not just that. It's also, and I've used this phrase before, but football's a world of spoofers and bluffers. And Bielsa is not that. He has got more integrity than pretty much anybody else in football. You know, he is driven by what he thinks is right. And in his younger days, he had he was really emotional, had a quite violent temper. Players he played for him spoke of being kind of almost slightly afraid of him. But although he'd regularly just rag you in games, so the famous game in the Copa America in 97 when Palermo missed the three penalties against Colombia, Bielsa was the coach, so it must have been 99 it must have been, and he got sent off. And his press conference isn't him justifying himself, it's not him talking about Palermo, it's him castigating himself, having lost control and saying, I deserve that red card, I've let everybody down. And there's very few people who I think are that self-analytical and that ruthless in how they assess themselves. And so you think even back to the Spygate thing, where he clearly kind of still felt he didn't quite understand what he'd done that was wrong. And to be honest, I'm with him on that. But that press conference that he gave afterwards, a 2-hour press conference, yeah, he was like, well, okay, if that's your rules, I'm really sorry. I didn't realize we won't do it again. And then he goes on about, you know, I do this, I go into this great detail, I research everything, and I know that actually a lot of it doesn't really make any difference. But I've got such a sense of guilt that I feel if I haven't overturned every stone, no matter how small, if I haven't looked at every possibility, that somehow I'm not doing my job. So he's this sort of massive neuroses, but he's incredibly honest and open and brutal about examining his own neuroses. So I think he's a good man. But one of the weirdest things that ever happened to me, I was in Chile for the Copa America 2015. So Bielsa's long gone by this point. And I lost my passport. And so I had to go to the embassy to get a new, like a temporary passport. And they said, "Oh, you need four photographs." So I was like, "Okay, where's the closest place?" And he went, "You just go down the street on the right. There's a shop there. Okay, so go down and explain what I want." And the bloke said, "Yeah, come into the back room. That's where my camera and everything is." And I go in and I sit down. I look up, and the three walls, the walls right ahead of me and the walls on either side, are totally covered in passport-sized photographs of Marcelo Bielsa. Because he used to go to that shop to get his photos done when he needed visas and whatever. And this bloke loved Bielsa so much, he just reproduced them and wallpapered his room in them. So it's like being in John Malkovich.
But the Alan Partridge.
Being John Malkovich. But, yeah. But just literally tens of thousands of Marcelo Bielsa's heads staring at me.
Now, Hector Bellerin has invested in Forest Green Rovers. He's another nice person, isn't he? The world's most environmentally friendly football club. So many people feel there's no solution to the world's problems, but Forest Green are already doing plenty. I'm so excited to be part of the FGR family. I'll be helping where I can, supporting people who want to change the world for the better. I heard Dale Vince, the owner of Forest Green, on the radio yesterday saying, you know, the conflict of interest, like officially there isn't one. Like, they, you know, there are official rules of being involved in more than one football club. And basically said, yes, if Arsenal draw Forest Green in the cup, he'll probably want Arsenal to win. That's Bellerin, not Dale Vince. So Dan says, for the next announcement of a live show, can we have Barry riding on a horse, charisma style? And what other modes of transport could we have him on for the big reveal? My suggestions would be tractor, Vespa or camel. It's a great video of him announcing he's signed for Vitoria. They say, do you want this car? And he goes, no. And then he's there riding on a horse in jean shorts as well, which I imagine would be quite uncomfortable.
Raphael one's very good, isn't it? Have you seen that?
No.
Joining, I think it's Istanbulspor, but he basically dresses like Raphael the turtle.
That is good. While we're on equine news, GB says, is Manchester United zebra kit the most disgusting kit ever seen in the Premier League era? And what animal do the panel think would make for the best kit and why? Jordan, your reaction to, have you seen this sort of zebra based?
It's maybe the worst kit in football. Forget the Premier League. It's shocking. And I know this is the third kit, right? It's the third kit. Not the away kit.
Yeah, third kit.
Right, yeah. So I know that the third kits are supposed to be really outlandish and crazy. They sell really well in parts of Australia and parts of the African continent. I understand that. But this is really, really bad. And they tried to kind of swing it with David Beckham wearing it, tried to make it relatively acceptable. But no, it's an awful kit.
Yeah, it's as producer Jack says, it's the shorts of zebra as well. It's full zebra. I think if it was just the shirt with like some more subtle shorts and socks, I think it might give opposition players a headache.
But you say that it's popular in parts of Africa. If you wear that in a Serengeti, you literally make yourself a target.
try and cross that river with the wildebeest. On the subject of goal music and PA announcers, I said that the worst, probably one of the worst things in football is a PA announcer. Well, PA announcers generally, but the ones that do the Christian name of a player and then expect the crowd to come in with the surname. Well, Joey Lynch got in touch to say, I can't speak for the rest of her new teammates, but Steph Catley did say during media rounds ahead of the W League Grand Final in Australia, she wanted the PA sounds and music to stay because it helped retain some sense of normalcy. Then Joey grassed us up to someone called Michael Turner, who is the PA announcer for the Western Sydney Wanderers in the A-League, who does do Christian name and then surname. And he was sad about it, Michael. He said, you know, just at me next time you want to be rude about me. But we agreed to disagree about Christian and surname announcers. Come on. You don't have many jobs as a PA announcer. You can do the whole name.
It's normally just when they score, isn't it? Well, that's in my experience.
Yeah.
Christian.
No,
Benzeke.
I think sometimes when they you picked yeah, quite an unlikely one.
Didn't you? I know I did.
some of them do it for just when they're announcing the whole starting lineup.
I'd say that's excessive.
It's terrible.
You want to hear the whole name as well. That's the point of a stadium announcer, isn't it?
Yeah, and when you're doing the team, can you just do it like nothing's happened yet? They might play badly. You just go number 5, Liam Daish. That's it. Like it's not Liam and then wait for Daish, is it? What if he has an absolute shocker? Finally, on the subject of what was number 1 in 1906, Barney has been in touch to say, I'm sure I'm the 100th person to point out, so be sure about this, Barney, you're the only person to point this out, that Autocorrect had me on Percy Dreamer as the co-editor of the English Hymnal. It was the less stylishly named Percy Dermer. I also mispronounced Ralph Vaughan Williams' name too, which I've done again. He says, you're the Mick McCarthy of English music. Anyway, look, we can't be good at everything or anything, but thank you for getting in touch. Greatly appreciated. And that'll do for today's podcast. Ed, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Jordan.
Cheers, mate.
Thank you, Wilson.
Cheers.
Tomorrow, a big Premier League preview. Barry Glendening, Lars Siverton and John Bruin. We'll look ahead to the season, which begins this weekend.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.